Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you The Creative Process, hosted by Nick Curto. Greetings and welcome, Nick. How are you this fine day?
Oh, wonderful. And I can, that your expression, this fine day, is right on the money, because it is a preview of spring. And we love spring. Yes, we do. So the temperatures were, as you know, in the low 50s, which is really cutting us a break. And boy, it's a preview that, hello, spring, we can't wait.
Indeed it is. I couldn't have said it better. I'm looking forward to your show tonight, as I look forward to your show every night, and your guest is here.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Hercules. And this is a live, a 60-minute podcast program on Blog Talk Radio, and the title is The Creative Process with Nick Curto, and I'm Nick Curto, your host. A very brief background about yours truly. I can never remember a time when I wasn't creative in my life, right from the very, very beginning. As a child, I did drawings, watercolors, paintings, constructed small sculptures, and produced my own puppet shows. I attended the George Walter Vincent Smith Art Museum classes in Springfield, Massachusetts, where I was born and grew up, and I attended the technical high school there. My dad was also from there, and I excelled in art classes and also drama classes, and attacked the school shows. I acted in many school shows and wrote scripts, designed stage sets and costumes, and I loved it all. I also designed the prom, the big prom dance, and the theme that was taken from a song by Burt Bacharach was Moon River, and it was a magical event which I will never forget. After high school graduation, I searched for an art school to apply to, and my first choice, my only choice, was the Massachusetts College of Art and Design in Boston, Massachusetts. And the letter came, and it said, you have been accepted, and it was one of those moments I'll never forget. I ended up taking the advertising graphic design course there, which totally fit me. And after graduation and getting my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, I headed directly on a Peter Pan bus from there to New York City to begin my advertising design career, which I've been doing now for a long time, and I certainly enjoyed it. I also pursued other creative outlets. That's a story I'll save for another time, but it's quite an adventure on many levels, and I will put that on for another program. The more various types of creativity to explore, the better, I have always found. And there's no limit to what kinds of creativity you can do in various mediums, in various ways. Okay, so with that, my featured guest for my podcast program tonight is a multi-talented and creative, very gifted a woman indeed. A very warm welcome to you, Jacqueline Sanchez.
Thank you, Nick. So nice to hear your voice.
And you too. And I've been so looking forward to this interview. I love, as I told you, I love your work, and we're going to talk a lot about that. I want to tell my listeners just a little brief thing about you, Jacqueline. So you are known for this fiber colorist, artist, designer with a machine knitted and then hand-stitched, breathtaking, beautiful, wearable art garments. And various parts of the garments are put together by meticulous hand crochet. And I've seen the photographs, and it's just flawless. Your work is absolutely flawless. The one-of-the-kind awesome garments that you do is magnificent, absolutely magnificent. And major celebrities, I read, had commissioned you for many, many years to do their wonderful outfits. Your cutting-edge design clothes have been seen in major films on television as well as Broadway theater productions. How exciting is that? That is so wonderful. When I read that, I was so happy for you. Now, before we begin your interview, I want to give a shout out to a very special and truly wonderful woman, as well as a mutual friend of ours, Diane Lebrecq from Montreal, Canada, who introduced us. I thank her so much for that. And Diane, if you're listening, much love to you always. Incidentally, on Saturday, March 23rd at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Diane Lebrecq will be my featured guest on my Urantia Book Spiritual podcast program right here on Blog Talk Radio. Now, Jacqueline, I would like to start right off at the very, very beginning. So may I ask you, please, first, where were you born and where do you make your home now?
Well, I was born in Flint, the famous Flint, Michigan, and grew up, though, in Ypsilanti, Michigan. That was my formative years from age 9 till I left home when I was 20, and lived in New York for 24 years, Montclair, New Jersey for 25, and since 2015, I've been in Stuart, Florida.
So you've seen various parts of the country. That's wonderful. Really nice to do something like that. Now, were you from a very big family with brothers and sisters, or were you the only child?
Actually, I was the middle of three. I have an older sister, 3 years older, who lives out on the West Coast. And my brother, who's 8 years younger, divides his time between Alaska and Colorado.
Wow, that's quite a leap there. Good for him. Now, your mom and dad, about them, a little bit about them. Were they in any way creative or not, or what were they like?
My dad was an engineer, and he worked for various companies throughout his career, but his favorite was the last job that he had, which was with Ford Motor Company. And he was really creative around the house. Like, a friend of his owned a rug store, a carpeting store, and he would get the samples from the carpeting store, and he made an abstract wall of cutout shapes of carpeting that he put together like a puzzle. And that was at the end of our living room. Sometimes he spray painted our Christmas trees, like 1 year beige, another year blue, another year silver. He just enjoyed doing different types of artistic things around the house. But he was passionate about being an engineer, and he worked with small companies that were making parts for the new cars that were coming out at Ford. So he loved his job. He made sure those lines were going, and that everything was up to date so that the cars would come out on time. My mom was a housewife. She didn't work at all when I was growing up, but she was very loving and very giving and a great mother. You know, I don't know what else to say about her except that I'm so hopeful that my daughter feels the same way about me that I felt about my mom. She was like my rock, my very special parent that I adored always.
I think that you were from a very fertile ground there with such love and such talent right around you. Well, just a quick question, too. Was any of your grandmother and grandfather on both sides, or any of your aunts or uncles, were any of them creative?
My grandmother, my mother's mother, was central to my career. When I was just 5, when she would come to visit, she would teach me how to knit with knitting needles, of course. And I loved it. I made doll clothes. I did everything I could do, little tiny scarves. And whatever I could, get my hands on, I really enjoyed knitting. And I had an ability to read patterns. So I was able to do some fairly complex things as I got older, and ultimately at 20, when I left home and moved to New York City, I was fairly penniless, so I got yarn at the Five and Dime and knitted everybody in my family a sweater for Christmas. So those were my beginnings as far as the knitting went. She also did paintings on porcelain. She tinted photographs. She made quilts and padded. She was very talented with her hands and with her artistry. And I learned at her knee. She was really a wonderful grandmother. Unfortunately, I was only 8 when she passed away. But she sure gave me a lifetime's worth of skills and interest in artistic creations and working with my hands. So I'm very grateful that I had her as brief of a time as she was in my life.
Absolutely. That's wonderful that you had surrounding those wonderful people with all that talent. And I can see how one thing led to the next as far as your career. It just is starting to make a lot of sense here, connecting the dots. Now, did you go to art school or anything like that during your life? Did you do that sort of thing?
Not in particular an art school, but I was always really interested in art, and art classes were my favorite any time that I things, whether it was drawing or painting or jewelry making. I had a fabulous art teacher when I was in high school who did centrifugal casting, silver casting with a centrifugal force apparatus that he designed and built. And I was a junior in high school and I was making silver jewelry. It was a very fertile ground. I went to a university high school, so small classes. We had professors for our teachers, and we learned a lot of not just artistic things, but music and advanced areas in reading, lecturing. It was an interesting place to have a high school education because it was a higher learning institution. So we really were gifted a lot of exciting and extraordinary opportunities for learning unusual and wonderful things.
Absolutely. That sounds great. And, you know, I've had painters, I've had choreographers, I've had all kinds of acting, all kinds of creative people on my show. But I've never had, you are the very first fiber colorist artist designer I've ever had. And I'd like you to, if you will, describe for my listeners what exactly that entails, because I think that some of them wouldn't probably know what that occupation is like. So if you will, if you could just give us some idea of what exactly is that?
Well, for me, the artistry comes from using thread, multiple colors of thread. All of it is viscose rayon. So it's made from wood pulp, and it dyes and has the tensile strength of silk. So it dyes like silk and has a sheen to it that's really quite wonderful. And it's very strong fiber. I came across it when I was working for a clothing designer in New York City who was a hand loom knitter. So that's using a knitting machine. And I had heard about her through a friend and called her up at their bidding to ask if I could have an apprenticeship. And she agreed and hired me and gave me a very small amount of money every week to work for her. But it was fertile ground. And I learned how to put garments together from a wonderful employee of this woman. Her name was Mae Smith, the woman that I learned my hand stitching, crocheted, edging, and all of that from was a Czechoslovakian woman named Rose Podany. And she was wonderful and became like not just my friend, but like a second mother to me. She was absolutely wonderful in my life. So Rose taught me a lot. The atmosphere at Mae Smith's was such that, you know, any area of the making of these beautiful, and they were rayon boucle, dresses and tops, We were a small group of people that were manufacturing these things that were sold at places like Bergdorf Goodman and iMagnum, all the fancy department stores that were around the country at the time. I was taught how to use the knitting machine the correct way from the start, and had people that were standing over me and making sure that I was learning it properly. So all of my education in this came through working. And being the apprentice and low person on the totem pole, so to speak, I was sent out to do errands. And one of those errands was picking up pieces and spools of the material that May used in her clothing. And it was a place called Majestic Rayon, which was in downtown New York City on 23rd and 6th Avenue. And they were completely in-house except for the raw material. So the rayon would come in and they would do the spinning, the dyeing, the putting them up on cones so that you could use them easily with machinery. They did everything but the manufacturing of garments from it. And their main customers in New York were the costume industry, because of the making of costumes like ballet costumes and also all of the accoutrement for theater, the velvet roping and the fringe that went on the curtains and everything that you could think of for working with the costume industry, the New York Broadway industry, they were sort of a part of all of that, supplying the what was needed for being successful in that milieu. So when May used to send me out, I would go to pick up things at Majestic. And my first time when I went, they were very busy, so I was told to just walk around and take a look. And I was this army green shelving that had hanks and hanks and hanks of colored thread was just like mind-boggling. It was floor to ceiling, hundreds of different colored hanks of thread, and I was completely overwhelmed by it. I was so excited when I saw it. And when I picked up the package for May, I noticed that there was a bin with a sign on the front said, cones of thread overruns, 50 cents each. So from that day forward, I took a $5 bill in my pocket when I would go to pick up things for May, and I would buy 10 cones of thread. And by the time I finished working for May, which was about 6 months, because she moved to California at the end of my time there with her, I had collected about 125 colors of thread, and I had my own knitting machine. So I was experimenting with that early on at home and realized that I needed much more than 125 colors of thread. So I had just gotten married. I was on a trip around the United States with my husband in a highway yellow pickup truck looking at the country for 7 weeks. In the early fall, we left in early October, and the colors were so magnificent, and I would have dreams about making something that I could wear out of all the colors that I was seeing on this trip. And when I came back, I decided I was going to make a kimono or a simple jacket, T-shaped jacket, and I had a different color combination mixing those colored threads together, because it had to be mixed. It couldn't be just one single thread, too thin to put on the machine. So I put four threads together and changed the colors systematically so they formed brief spectrums. And each sleeve was a different part of the country. The back was another part of the country, and both fronts were a different part of the country, with all the colors flowing into one another. So that was the first time I made a piece of clothing from the knitting machine. And I made a deal with Majestic Rayon that they would put two skeins of my weight thread in every dye lot that they produced in their company. And over the years, I've collected well over 2,000 different colors of thread that I've used in my garments. And unfortunately, they stopped manufacturing in 2017. So that source has dried up. And there's not very many other sources because viscose is not an easy thing to manufacture. And it's, you know, now you've got polyester and modal kinds of plastics almost that can make wonderful fabrics. So viscose is sort of relegated now to embroidery companies. So that's where it's going. So as I'm running out of colors, I don't know where I'm going to get replacements, but I still have about 1,800 cones of thread, so I guess I'm not going to be without anything for quite a while yet.
Well, you know, I saw the website that shows your amazing collection of most beautiful colors, the beautiful threads, and there's so many of them. And it was such a, you could just see the joy that you have, that you just love to get into the, probably the mood of color. I'm sure that's part of it, and the joy and how it makes you feel. And you really have got that down so beautifully. And your clothes are stunning. When the first time I saw what you had been doing, I was so impressed. I hadn't seen before clothes, high-end clothes that were that amazing. It almost seemed to me like clothes of the future, because they had a certain, I haven't seen them before, that was something that was brand new. And I could see that that sort of design, that sort of flair could be definitely used in future clothing because it's a joyful look. And you have such a magnificent, what shall I say, eye for subtlety of color, and the way that one color very slowly blends into another color and then another color. And it's almost like it almost looks like a growth, like some sort of organic thing that's going on that you are controlling in a very joyful way. And it just comes across as totally amazing. I love your work. I got to say that it also looks, and this is a compliment, not overworked. It looks so natural, like it just always existed. Has anyone ever said that to you?
Actually, not in that way, and I love it because it kind of coalesces everything that I feel about what I do. I really enjoy those subtleties in color. And even though I have 1,500 cones of thread, I'm missing a lot of colors. There's many that I don't have easy transitions into the next color. So I have to find one that works. And so it's forced me to maybe even sometimes breaking a few color rules in order to have a transition work its way through. And that's the exciting part of what I do. It's kind of scary at times too, because you think, oh, I don't know if I'm going to make it to get this thing to work properly. But I find that if I keep at it, ultimately I'm able to break through, and that subtlety and color change really does happen. And sometimes it'll be out of the blue. I'll find a color that's completely different, like a brown when I'm looking for an orange. And that color of brown works to make that transition just right. So I feel blessed in that I can really work with everything that I have and create just about any subtlety and change that I want in order for it to look, you know, as I've imagined that it should.
Well, you certainly have succeeded on that level, because it's exquisite. Your work is absolutely exquisite. And I was just going to say to you that in thinking about threads and color and perhaps silk and China, have you explored looking for the products that you need in China?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I found Alibaba, which is like the Chinese version of Amazon, and went to look. And of course, during the pandemic, the charges for shipping went over the moon. And there's two aspects of working with this through China that are they're difficult. They do have viscose, and it is manufactured over there still. But getting the right size of viscose and the right colors is out of my control. I really can't just see by looking on the Alibaba roster of manufacturers what would work for me and be the right size thread and so forth and so on. Then the shipping costs are what's really daunting, not to mention minimums. The shipping costs oftentimes are as much as 10 times the cost of the actual product.
Wow.
To bring it over here, like a 10-pound or 15-pound box of my thread, by the time it would get here, it would be $200 or $300 just to ship it. So
ouch,
that becomes
ouch.
Daunting, not to mention that I don't have any control over size and color. And unfortunately, it's not in my budget to run over to China to take a look. So I'm kind of forced to live with what I have. But there's an aspect to that that's also challenging as well as very exciting, because like I've said, finding those odd colors that kind of make that transition happen, or to surprise me and make it something unique and different that I hadn't even planned on. That's all part of the artistry, the balancing of the different elements to make things happen. So for me, it's at one time I thought, oh no, what am I going to do? Majestic's not here anymore. But the other side of it is that I have so much product with what I own already, and I just want to keep working on that and making it happen and making those things out of, making everything that I'm doing out of what I have already. It's kind of wonderful. I don't know how else to describe it. It's just that phase in my life now where I don't need more. I just need to work with what I have.
Right, right. I totally understand what you're saying there, and how true that is too. And there's never enough time. I think you'd agree with that. There's just never enough time to do all the creative things that you really want to do, because your mind races of, I want to do this, and I want to design that, and a dress, or perhaps a cape, or it goes on. And of course, it all takes time. And I have to compliment you on your patience, because this is something that just doesn't happen to go from a sketch to the actual final product in a day or something quick. This is a methodical process, and it shows in your work. I love it. It's almost like doing a journey of color. That's one way to look at that. Could you give the listeners here perhaps some ways of looking at your work through a website or something like that? If you could slowly give them an address of a website so they could take a look. And I highly recommend that my listeners do take a look at your beautiful, beautiful work. So if you could, just do it slowly so they can write it down.
Okay. It's, of course, www.knittedware.com. KNITTEDWARE.com.
Knittedware.com. And it's got some beautiful photographs of you and your work, and it really just shows the level of subtlety of color and your understanding. And it's almost like you're on a journey, and you're taking us with you to say, from this color, we can blend it into some other color, and this is the middle ground. And, oh, by the way, there's a yellow that's coming in, and look, here it is, and it's starting to go a little bit orangey, but it's maintaining the yellow. And it's like a journey of color. That's one way I would describe it to other people of your work. It's a journey. And it is quite beautiful, really. I've never seen anything quite like it. Now, I listed at the beginning that you have been had some wonderful success with selling your work to some very prominent people. And if you could tell us not only who was buying your beautiful clothing, but a little bit about their personalities, if you met them, like what were they like or that sort of thing. Would you be able to do that for us?
I can give you some of that. When I was first starting, and after I first made that jacket that was from my honeymoon, imaginings and viewings of this beautiful country we live in, I decided that I heard about Julie Artisan's gallery, which was a wearable art gallery on Madison Avenue in the 60s, and it was owned and operated by a woman named Julie Schaffler Dale. She invented the wearable art movement, and it was through her that I was able to have great success in selling my work. Back in 1978, I took my work to the gallery and was accepted as a member of the artists group at that gallery. And Julie had a small gallery between 62nd and 63rd Street on Madison Avenue. And the way that she featured her artists was to give them windows full of their artwork for 2 weeks at a time. So for two wonderful weeks, each artist would have two windows on Madison Avenue filled with their artwork. And it took a while because I was also making costumes for the costume industry and a few other things. I had a line of sweaters as well during that whole time back there in the mid to late 70s. And I decided that if I was going to be with Julie, I better start making more works for her. And by 1981, she finally gave me my show in early March of 1981. And at the time, I had been to Washington and gone to the National Gallery and seen a display of luminist painters there, the old Frederick Church and Bierstadt and wonderful, wonderful artists that did seascapes and landscapes, beautiful things, lots of northern lights and sunsets and sunrises and just gorgeous, gorgeous paintings. And those were an inspiration for a group of nine jackets. So I call them kimonos, but they're like happy coats. They're basic T-shaped jackets. And the colors go from one end of the sleeve to the other. So the colors go horizontally, not vertically. So all of those jackets were just the best I had ever done to that point. And Julie would take in the work on Thursday night, and the show would start on Friday, and then 2 weeks later it would come down on a Thursday night, and so forth and so on. So late that Thursday night, about midnight, my husband and I drove up to Julie's gallery. We were living in Tribeca, and she was up on 62nd Street. And I was just thrilled. The window looked great. And then 2 days later, we went on a vacation. And when I came back, there was only three or four more days left for the show to be up at Julie's. And I didn't know what to do. So I called the gallery and my friend Paul, who was the manager at the time, answered the phone and said, well, how was your trip? And I said, great. And I said, so what's going on? What happened? And he says, oh, that's right. You don't know. He said, last week, Yoko Ono and David Geffen came in. We had to close the shop down because she wanted to try on everything of yours that was in the window. And he said, so she was trying them on. And as she took each jacket off, she kind of put it into a pile on the floor next to her. And at the end of trying on all the jackets, she pointed to the pile and said, "I'll take this." So he said, I raced over and picked up the top kimono. And I said, "This one?" And she said, "No, all of them." And out of the 9 jackets that I had in that show, she took 7. And I was unbelievably gobsmacked, needless to say, my first show at the gallery. And that's what happened. Over the years, there were other people that came and bought my work. But towards the end of our stay in New York, we left to go to Montclair in 1990. In 1989, Elizabeth Taylor bought both windows of my work because she was waiting at the light to go over to the on Madison Avenue, and she was going to go around the corner to the St. Regis Hotel. And the car stopped for the light, and she looked over and saw the windows full of my things. So Chen Sam, her manager and a friend, called the gallery the next day and asked for the whole 2 windows to be sent over to the St. Regis. And Elizabeth bought all of them. And I was always kind of curious to know, because I never got to meet her. They were all different sizes. It wasn't like there was just one size fits all. So I don't know if she bought them all as gifts for family and friends or what. I just was always curious about that. But it was really a thrill to have both of those women, both of whom I admire so much, that became collectors of my work. I was, needless to say, thrilled.
How wonderful a story. Those stories are absolutely terrific. Thank you so much for sharing them. Wow. Wonderful, joyful stories. And that was deserved, because it your work, people will see that and they stop, because they've never seen anything quite like that. And it's not in your face either. It's subtle. It's subtle, subtle color transitions. And it's just a beautiful artistic journey that you do. Now, as far as I know, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you're designing a clothing for women. And my question is, have you ever thought of, or have you done, scarves or neckties and bow ties for men, anything like that?
Yes, I've always made scarves for women and for men. And I also actually made a kimono for Jimmy Cliff, among other people that of the male species. I have actually made clothing for. I made a pair of leg warmers, gold leg warmers for Mick Jagger. And I made some tights for Rock Hudson when he was briefly in Camelot. And that's a funny story. And then I hand-knitted chain mail for Richard Burton when he was King Arthur for Camelot on Broadway, which was arduous. Needless to say, I lost a few layers of skin because I had to use this very rough gold twine, and I hand-knitted them on huge knitting needles so it would look like chain mail. So I've done a few things for men. But yes, I always make scarves. Women are more attracted to them than men, but I've given gifts to a lot of my male friends, and they always wear their scarves, so that's a good thing.
Have you ever gone to the Broadway shows where your work was on stage? Have you seen it that way?
I've seen everything I've ever made on stage, absolutely. Here's a great story. For Sweeney Todd, the original play for Sweeney Todd, I made Angela Lansbury's top. And I made about, whenever you do things for a Broadway show, you have to make multiples. Like I did 2 sweaters for a chorus line, one for Zach, character Zach, whose voice you always hear, and the other character is Bobby, who was on the stage, and they both had sweaters. And I made, over a course of about 10 years, over 120 sweaters for those combined, for those two characters. But I did also some sweaters for Sammy Davis Jr. for Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And I made, of course, for him, very meticulous guy. He had to have six of the identical sweaters. So that was another costume that I made using my threads. And Sweeney Todd, back to Sweeney Todd, it was one of those magical nights. My husband and I were whisked up to the theater, and we watched the show, and the costume designer was Franny Lee. She and her husband were the costume designers for Saturday Night Live. And so I got to stay in, my husband and I were in the audience watching the entire production. And then afterwards, we went through and Franny showed us all the costumes for everybody, how the wigs were utilized, some of the props. And then when we were finished, she said, well, got to go over to get ready at Rockefeller Center for the weekend, so why don't you take our limo home? So we got into their limo and got a ride home. And other than the fare for the subway to get there earlier in the evening, it was a pretty magical night. I got to tell you, it was just fabulous to sit there and watch my clothing on the stage on this wonderful actress and a fabulous play.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wonderful. What a night that would have been. Did you see it with Angela Lansbury?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it was the preview, the last of the preview nights. So she was in it, and it was amazing. The first costume job that I had was for Twyla Tharp and her dance company, and the designer was Santa Laquasto. See, with the costume designs, I always worked with a costume designer. I was the renderer. I was the knitter and the renderer. I was not the designer of these costumes. But it was always fantastic because I would collaborate with the designer on, what kind of fibers they wanted to use, what kind of colors, so forth and so on. And when I worked with Santo on Twyla Tharp's debut at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, there was this first premiere number. Was the basic subject matter was a basketball team, or two basketball teams. So I had to make, they had panne velvet shorts that were, of course, sewn by the costume company. And then I made all of the tops. So there were orange tops and purple tops. And then there were a bunch of socks that I made also for them to wear. And they danced their dance in tennis shoes. And it was so exciting. Santa Laquasto was starting his meteoric rise to fame and fortune. And I had never made patterns in my life. And I had brought quarter-inch graph paper and sat with yellow pads. I didn't own a calculator at the time. And I figured out how to make all those patterns for those pieces. And I think I've stayed up by the end of my project with them. I stayed up probably the last four nights straight without, having a cat nap now and again, just to make sure everything got done in time for the opening night. It was amazing, and it was very exciting and anxiety-producing, but very successful. So I knew that if I could get through that I could probably continue without as much of a trauma as trying to go through. I think I went through four yellow pads at the time I got all of those costumes made. There were, I think, 10 different costumes. So, oh, dear. It was wonderful, though. I really enjoyed it, and it got me on my way with all of the costume stuff, which I did for about 8 years. That was really great.
Oh, yeah. What wonderful stories and memories that you're sharing with us. And so exciting to see your work on that level and take off and then be enjoyed by audiences and prominent people. Have you walked on a New York street and seen something that you had designed being worn by someone else walking past you? Have you had that experience?
Necessarily a stranger, but you know, Julie had a large clientele of Madison Avenue ladies and Park Avenue ladies, so. Occasionally I would see somebody with something on, but it was usually at the gallery. You know, I would stop by and see Julie and hang out for a little bit here and there. And the ladies would come in and some would be wearing their tops or their dresses. The best, though, was working with the clientele because oftentimes they would want something custom made. And that was not only a challenge, but just a delight to sort of get into their heads about what kind of colors they liked against their skin, what their color memories were. You know, it wasn't just about, oh, let's design red. It was about, well, how do you see red on you? What kind of color of red do you want near your face? And do you like rose reds or orange reds? Or, you know, it was always a wonderful experience working with somebody to get their dream produced and made. And then I would have the challenge of putting it all together. But everything starts with a swatch. Nothing is made without a test piece of fabric that I put together. And many times I would make up to 6 or 7 or 8 different swatches for people to choose from. And then there was the actual making of the piece. And I was very lucky with my pattern making. Big reason for my pattern successes is the material itself, which has, you know, you think of a knit as having a lot of stretch. But the rayon thread is twisted so tight that it doesn't have much stretch. It actually, when it's steamed flat, I can put it into a perfect rectangle or square or whatever shape I've made, and it will keep its shape. The only thing you can't do with it is to hang it on a hanger. You have to keep them folded like any other kind of sweater. You need to keep them folded, put in a drawer or a bag or something. But I didn't really see it on the streets, but I have down here in Florida, which is great because I've made garments for prominent people in Stuart, Florida, where I live. So, of course, when I go to events here, I do see other people in the things that I've made them. So that's always a pleasure.
That would be so much fun to see someone that you're wearing what you had designed. That would be so much fun to see that. And a joyful experience. I'd like to take a moment here to say that to our listeners that if you have a comment or a question that you'd like to ask my guest this evening or myself, I'd like to encourage that. I'm going to give you my personal email address, and you could use that email address and put your question or your comment there. And if it's for me, I will answer it. And if it's for my guest tonight, I will send it to her. So let me give you that. I'll do it slowly so you'll get it correctly. So here we go. If you'd like to do that, my email address is nicknyny1. And that's the numeral 1, not O-N-E, but the numeral 1, at gmail.com. Going to repeat it, nicknyny1, at gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. You mentioned earlier that working with some prominent people probably has some adventures and perhaps a good story to that. Is there one particular or a couple that you remember that would be of interest?
I'm just trying to think here.
Perhaps somebody that either was difficult or fun or something that you didn't expect when you're working with someone like that?
I hope that this will be appropriate for the news, the radio waves.
Oh, okay.
I was crazy as a young girl. I was crazy for Rock Hudson. I thought he was the best. And
yep.
when I got the opportunity to make his gold tights for being King Arthur briefly on Broadway in Camelot, I said to the costume company owner that I was not only excited to be making this for him, but that I would really love it if I had the opportunity to meet him in person.
Sure.
So this was, I think, just at the beginning when Rock Hudson was starting to suffer from being exposed to the AIDS virus. And at the time, his manager was also his lover, and that was also not quite known to the public. When I made the tights, I brought them to the costume company, and I waited for a while the manager came out, and he said, "Well, Mr. Hudson can see you soon, and wanted to step over here with me." And we walked into this side room at the costume company, and there was Rock Hudson. And I smiled and introduced myself, and then I handed him his tights. And he unfolded them, and he held them up, and he turned them one way, and then he turned them the other way. And then he kind of leaned over towards me, and he says, "I guess one would have to wear a J-O-C."
Oh, great.
And then his manager said, "Well, Mr. Hudson's busy now. I guess we need to take you out of the room." And I left, and those were the last words I heard from Rock Hudson.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, brother.
I just thought that was just amazing.
Oh, you can't even write that. That's just got to happen in real life. That's wonderful. Rock Hudson and Doris Day movies are, I was always, still am a big fan. I had a big crush on Doris Day at the time. And that combination, those two people, what magic did on the screen. That combination just worked. And the writing was excellent also in those movies. So I remember that as just wonderful movies. And when they're shown on TV, I enjoy them just as much now as I did when they first came out.
Oh, me too. Me too. I loved it. That whole era. You know, I would play sick sometimes if I knew Million Dollar Movie was going to have a Fred Astaire movie on the next day. I'd wake up the next morning and pretend I was sick so I could stay home on the couch and watch the movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to ask my producer, Hercules, how much time do we have remaining? I know we're coming close to the end. Hercules, how much time do we have left?
We have approximately 6 minutes.
6 minutes, okay. I do have an ending that I always say at the end of my podcast, so I will be doing that. But in the meantime, is there anything you'd like to leave a thought with our listeners about creativity or about your work, something that you'd just like to leave briefly with our listeners?
I'd just like to say that anyone out there who is inspired by an artistic urge, to never ignore that, to go into it, be patient with that feeling, and make sure that you attempt and keep attempting to do what's in your heart and mind when it comes to a creative endeavor. A lot of times things don't come easily right away, but then when the reward starts to come in, when the beautiful works that start to come flowing out of you, it is such an amazing reward, so worth waiting for, so worth working hard for. And then I'm at that stage in my life now where I still go through, you know, difficulties at times trying to put my works together. But ultimately, every single time, they all coalesce, they all come together. And for me, the beauty of what I do is that as I'm ironing those pieces, that's when they start to really resonate. What those creations are actually have become, and how they are manifesting themselves, and it's always a reward. It's always a thrill. So stick with whatever you've got. If you have an inclination towards an artistic endeavor, don't give up. Keep going. Keep working at it. And eventually you will be rewarded, I promise.
Well said, Jackie. Well said. You're right on the money on that one, right on target. I could not agree with you more. A lot of truth in what you said. Thank you so much. You were a joy to have on the program, and just continued success. Hopefully when I get to Florida sometime, I would love to go to your shop and see your work, but a wonderful interview. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Nick. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope that you have great success with your podcast. I will certainly be tuning in. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Nick Curto for The Creative Process, wishing you all an enlightened and exciting journey as you find your own path to deepen your creative energies and more fully develop your talents of creative expression in your life as it takes you. Till next time, fully embrace your creativity in one or more areas of expression. Stay safe and be very, very kind to one another. Much love to everyone out there everywhere. Till next time, goodbye for now. Much love.